Before we call the last case for this sitting, I would like to, on behalf of the court, welcome Park Falls High School students who are with us today. Would the Park Falls High School students please stand? Well, welcome. Thank you for coming, and we hope that you will enjoy and learn from this argument. You may be seated. There are synopses of this case out on the tables behind you, as well as other materials about the court, and you are welcome to take the ones you wish. Now that we've been introduced to you, I would like to introduce the court to all of you. On my far right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her left is Justice John Wilcox. And to my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. And I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice William Babbage. To his left is Justice Jeanine Geske. And on the far left is Justice Patrick Crooks. With those amenities done, we'll proceed to call 97-1316 CR State v. Matthew Jansen. Representing the state is Vincent Biskupic, who is the district attorney in Appleton. Podium is too high or too low. You may adjust it by a button on your left side of the podium.
Feels about right. Thank you.
Okay.
Chief Justice, Justices, my name is Vince Biskupic. I'm the Allegheny County District Attorney, and I represent the plaintiff appellate petitioner in this matter. Petitioner requests that the Wisconsin Supreme Court uphold the trial court's finding that the defendant's conduct in this case in defecating on a United States flag is not conduct which is sufficiently imbued with elements of communication to fall within the scope of First Amendment protection. State further requests that the court affirm the Court of Appeals District 3 ruling that the provision of the statute charged in this case is not unconstitutionally vague. Finally, the petitioner requests that the court reverse the decision of District 3 Court of Appeals, finding that the Wisconsin statute, section 946.05 sub 1, is unconstitutionally overbroad and cannot be preserved with an appropriate limiting construction. State requests that the focus of the court's decision be on the overbreadth issue and whether an appropriate limiting construction and severing can be used so the statute would not be facially overbroad.
Let me just ask you a question in that regard. By asking that there be severance of that statute, are you conceding that parts of the statute are unconstitutional?
We're conceding specifically on the provision of the caste contempt language based on the Smith v. Gogan language.
Yep. So my next question to you, if you would, just so I can focus on the argument, you're asking us then to read this statute in a particular manner. So would you tell us how you want this statute read?
At a minimum, we would request...
What statute are we talking about?
946.05.
946.05. Okay. And it says whoever intentionally and publicly mutilates, defiles, or casts, what's the language of the statute?
Casts contempt upon the flag.
Casts contempt on the statute is guilty or subject to a fine. How do you want us to read that statute?
At a minimum, after severing, we'd ask that it read, whoever intentionally and publicly defiles a flag is guilty of a crime.
Okay, now suppose you defile the flag with the intent of contempt, or casting contempt, public expression of contempt, expressive conduct. Is that going to be all right under the statute?
If there are situations where a defiling statute would hypothetically touch expressive conduct, I think the case of Broderick v. Oklahoma determines that we must find substantial overbreadth. And in that case, it specifically says, yes, we may hypothesize that there are some conduct that it could reach. Mm-hmm. But in those cases, it suggests we go back to a case-by-case analysis, and basically I interpret that as using the as-applied analysis as a safety net on those hypothetical cases.
You don't want us to read in only if it's non-expressive conduct.
Correct. This court has acknowledged the U.S. Supreme Court cases of Broderick v. Oklahoma and New York v. Ferber in this court's ruling in Thiel on the overbreadth analysis. The Thiel case involved the statute 948.11 on exposing a child to harmful materials. That statute has a severance clause in it, subparagraph 5. Although the flag statute doesn't have a severance clause, it would fall under the rules of construction of chapter 990.
Let me ask you on the severability. Is there any argument that Wisconsin does not have the presumption of severability?
I would think, based on chapter 990, sub 11, that 990.01, sub 11, that our statutes are presumed to be severable.
Now, is this a 1917 statute?
1919.
What's the background on this statute? Was it passed because of the First World War?
Pardon
me? Was it passed because of the First World War and people in Wisconsin taking an isolationist position and not wanting to get into the war? Is that why it was passed, or what did you know?
I think in the brief submitted by both sides, both of us did searching to see if there was legislative history still maintained from that era, and there wasn't. There were some revisions that the defense...
Did you check the newspapers?
I didn't.
The background? Okay.
The state has mentioned that once the court uses the option of severance, that the caste contempt language that was ruled inappropriate in Smith v. Gogin could be severed. The state believes that the remaining provisions, at a minimum the defiling provision, can withstand the overbreadth analysis from Broderick. In Broderick, the majority decision wrote that some broadly worded laws, quote, may deter protected speech to some unknown extent, but there comes a point where that effect, at best a prediction, cannot with confidence justify invalidating the statute on its face. The Broderick decision goes on to talk about an overbroad statute must not only be, the overbreadth must be real but substantial as well. It goes on to talk about that fallback position, the case-by-case analysis, that whatever overbreadth may exist should be cured through case-by-case analysis on the fact situations which its sanctions assertedly may be applied. So that takes us to the next question. If we have a statute that says whoever intentionally and publicly defiles a flag, will that survive under Broderick?
Would you just articulate the test then? When and under this reading of the cases that you've been reciting to us, must a court find that a statute's unconstitutional because of overbreadth? And when is the court to simply do it on a case-by-case basis? Where's the line?
I think the line is when you have real and substantial overbreadth. And if you have something less than that, then you should fall back to the case-by-case analysis suggesting Broderick.
How is that interpreted in the cases in terms of what does it mean, real and substantial overbreadth?
I think the cases look back at fact situations, potentially even cited historically in case law, and look at the definition of the provisions of the statute to see, well, would this sweep of this definition cover examples that are historically in case law?
So you search for examples and see how many of them...
As opposed to hypothesizing. I think when they use the language, the prediction language and speculation, that I think they want us to look for real examples in case law and history.
Mr. Biskupic, let me ask you a question, if I might, on something that you touched upon earlier, and that's the issue of severability. It's my understanding that the Court of Appeals decision basically said we don't have any legislative history, so we can't sever. What's your response to that?
Well, the 1919 statute, we didn't find any original history. I know the defense has talked about in revisions that there was some, presumably, issues related to greater protection for this type of property with the characters of a national symbol or of national origin, things of that sort. So assuming the goal is to give extra protection to this type of property of specific character or special character, You have three provisions that are reaching that goal. By removing one, you don't necessarily pervert that goal of protection. So I don't think severance flies in the face of the intent.
Is that consistent to take that approach? Is that consistent with U.S. Supreme Court decisions and also Wisconsin decisions?
It's consistent with Chapter 990 on rules of construction and also some of the federal cases that I cited where there's a presumption of severability.
So in other words, what you do if you don't have legislative history, you look at whether or not there's anything that would show that the intent of the legislature was that they wouldn't have passed the statute if the provisions that you want to sever were absent. Is that an appropriate approach?
I think in some of the cases that I cited at federal level in my brief talked about that presumption that a legislature wouldn't just create these laws for the sake of creating laws and sanctions without that type of thought process.
Mr. Skupik, can you give me some examples, other than carrying a flag behind you that's cited in all these cases, in which the act towards the flag, which does defile or mutilate the flag, is not expressive conduct?
Yes, I will. And I think that's important to consider in light of what I'm going to ask you to do in your decision is to adopt the rationale of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in Commonwealth v. Bricker, 1995 case, which that trial court originally said all conduct towards a flag because of some symbolic nature would be protected speech, but the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, in citing the example of the one Justice Babbage just did, footnote 3 in Texas v. Johnson, also cited in another footnote the case of City of Cincinnati v. Bunch, where the defendant was convicted of defiling the flag for his actions in using the flag as a knapsack and rug on the street. There's also cited in the state's brief, Van Slyke v. Texas, for example, where a defendant was convicted under that statute for acts of blowing his nose in the flag and also rubbing the flag on his genitals. We also have, in the present case, as an example, the defecation.
Why do you think he did that?
Why do I think he did it? And we've always alleged in our paper.
He didn't have a handkerchief.
Oh, in Van Slyke?
Why do they do that? Are you giving these as examples of defiling a flag that would be covered by this statute?
In the state's belief, yes, those would be covered.
That are not expressive.
Well, correct.
And, the chief asked the obvious question. Why did he just not have a handkerchief when he decided he had to blow his nose in the flag?
It was basically horseplay at a library at a university, forget which one, if it's University of Houston or Rice down in Texas, where defendant was basically engaged in horseplay, had consumed some alcohol, and for some non-expressive reason.
You would concede then, and I'll stop asking questions, but you would concede that if in fact the act is an expression of speech towards the flag, then it cannot be prosecuted.
With just that step, I don't concede that, because in Texas v. Johnson, Justice Brennan talks about the first thing we have to do in the applied framework is to look at the conduct and decide whether it's sufficiently imbued with elements of speech. And even beyond that, we have to look at the issue of whether the language indicates.
Well, what if on the back of the back sack, for instance, but I use this flag as a back sack because I have total and utter contempt for everything that this flag symbolizes?
Well, not only
can he be prosecuted?
Potentially, yes. We have to look at not only
successfully.
I think we can. I would explain that beyond your expressed intent, maybe after the fact or even as you're doing it, an intent to convey a particularized message needs to be present, and there needs to be a great likelihood that the message would be understood by those viewing it. So,
do you have any doubt about Justice Babbage's knapsack message?
On the back, on the knapsack, on the flag that he's using as a knapsack, he says, I use this flag as a knapsack because I have total and utter contempt for everything this flag symbolizes.
If you create a context under your hypothetical where you are verbally expressing that, maybe in broad daylight walking down the street, then I think we have, at least as applied, potential problems on applying a statute to that.
Well, you agree then that would be, it would be unconstitutional to prosecute that knapsack.
Only as applied if all...
That's what we're doing when we prosecute.
Right.
Here.
But not just the context of using it as a knapsack. There needs to be other factors in the context when a viewer of that is trying to figure out the likelihood of what this message is. He could carry the knapsack down the street and not say anything, drop it on the ground, get it dirty, and not have any intent to express an idea. He falls more into the protection when he walks down with the knapsack and maybe says, you know, I'm from this group, or this is who I am, and I've been wronged by the government, and this is why I'm doing this to this flag in the form of a knapsack.
It seems that the hypotheticals in some of the discussion make the distinction, actually, between defiling and intent to defile. There can be hypotheticals given that defile the flag, but perhaps leave questionable whether or not there is an intent to defile. This statute we have, even with your suggestion of severing, has intent to defile. Isn't the phrase intent to defile inherently expressive?
Well, for example, the person who blows his nose on it is basically engaged in horseplay, maybe an intent to offend somebody to some degree, but it doesn't explicitly always mean it's going to be expressive conduct towards the foot.
But the statute we have here is not just defiling, not just having... Oh, I have to blow my nose, and where's some cloth? That's the closest cloth. That may end up defiling the flag. The statute requires intent to defile. Defile, rather. And I believe that is inherently, or can be interpreted as inherently expressive. What's your response to that?
I would ask you to interpret it to also include intentional acts of vandalism, horseplay, things along that vein that an outside viewer has required in Texas v. Johnson to try and understand the message and the likelihood of the message would not find expressive.
Horseplay or vandalism, you could say, with intent to damage, but we're not talking about intent to damage. Defile has a meaning with the word detent that I think arguably has expressive connotation, if not meaning. I look at the Eichmann case, which is a more recent Supreme Court case than the Broderick case that you're citing. And in that case, it's a 1989 case, the statute had mutilate, deface, defile, and burn. And the U.S. Supreme Court indicated that the statute, from its terms, suffers from the same fundamental flaw as the statute did in the Johnson case in Texas, and that is it suppresses expression out of concern for its likely communicative impact. How do you get around that language in Eichmann? As it defines defile in the footnote, footnote 7 is attached to that.
Well, in your decision in this matter for the state to, or the petitioner to prevail, there has to be a construction of defile that is narrow enough that the sweep of it would not be substantial towards potential expressive conduct. And the state has suggested a definition of defile in our reply brief. It talks about to make physically unclean, especially with something unpleasant or contaminating. And the District 3 also suggests the definition is to make dirty, to be foul. Those words, the plain meaning of those words, and there are some cases that contrast defile and physical acts to pass contempt, which I think opens the door for more expressive conduct, specifically in the case of another Pennsylvania case that is cited, found when shepherdizing the Gogan case, Commonwealth v. Morgan, was an example of somebody putting the patch of a flag on their trousers, similar to what's described in the Texas case in the state's brief, DeLorme, and also in Smith v. Gogan. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in that case of Commonwealth v. Morgan. It's 331 Atlantic 2nd at 444. Spent a portion of their decision saying, okay, we're going to distinguish defile from cast contempt. And basically, they construed defile to mean only physical acts, and that's what we're asking you to do in this case, to construe defile as only physical acts. And they found that the more expressive acts, including verbal acts and the using of the patch, were under the cast contempt language. And by narrowing our statute down to the physical acts of intentionally defiling and removing the cast contempt language, we can do limiting construction that is much easier than the suggested limiting construction that you encountered, or this court encountered in the State versus Roten case with the Milwaukee resisting ordinance, where the city of Milwaukee wanted to have the construction focus just on physical acts and remove the verbal acts from the language, I believe it was in any way. And there was, the majority felt it was more difficult. But in this case, when we have provisions that are separate and distinct, and where verbal acts fall under the cast contempt versus the intentional physical acts under a defiling, it's much easier to perform the limiting construction suggested.
The Eichmann Court defined defile as to make filthy, to corrupt the purity or perfection of, to rob of chastity, to make unclean, and then said that term and the other terms, mutilate, deface, and burns, said each of the specified terms unmistakably connotes disrespectful treatment of the flag and suggests a focus on those acts likely to damage the flag's symbolic value.
It seems to me that court, that language of that decision is going to be tough for you to try to redefine.
Well, we've suggested in our briefs, and District 3 has suggested even a more limited definition of defile, which I think this court, as the highest state court, has the ability to do in limiting construction. As Pennsylvania's Supreme Court has done, they've limited the definition of defile to be more narrow even than what has been suggested in the Eichmann case.
Does Pennsylvania have an intentional publication and in public standard?
I believe it does. They've changed their law over the years to even have a provision that basically has applied defense.
What do you think the intent of the legislature is here?
I believe the intent of the legislature is to create a greater level of protection for a property that has characteristics that are of national origin, of government, of potential spiritual level, almost on the par of a religious piece of property.
Well, why don't you, doesn't it cover if I burn the flag or mutilate it in my home? I mean, if they're trying to protect this property, why doesn't the legislature cover private burning, private mutilation? I mean, after all, they cover a whole series of acts in private that people can't do. That's perfectly constitutional. Why wouldn't they do that?
I don't know if they considered including public and private, but I think they probably looked at the practicality of enforcing something like that.
Well, but you do it all the time. There are just loads of criminal acts that are private. Murder could be just two people. Nobody sees it. Sexual assaults.
Delivery
of drugs. Two people. Nobody sees it. I mean, if you really are out to get something and you really are out to do the national symbol, it would seem to me it would cover private act or not. I suggest to you that the intentional and the public, along with the words cast contempt, is an attempt to get at a public expression of contempt, whether it's done with words, holding the flag, which would be under cast contempt, or it's done through destruction. Now, maybe the statute will also take into play horseplay or the lack of a handkerchief or whatever. Do you think that the blowing your nose because you don't have something else in your hands and available and you intentionally blow your nose, do you think that's an intentional defiling of the flag?
Yes. The statute created, even narrowed down to what the state is suggesting, will have a sweep towards those real examples.
If I intentionally blow my nose
into a handkerchief, certainly that's not a defiling of my handkerchief.
No, it's making it dirty.
Okay, so what if I blow my nose into a sheet? Am I defiling that sheet?
Yes. It's making it dirty, unclean.
Mr. Biskupic, on what basis did the trial judge in this case determine that this was non-expressive conduct? Did he explain his determination at all on the record?
I think the transcript reflects that he made reference to the Texas v. Johnson case and looked at the actions of the defendant, whether there were sufficient elements of communication, the time of day, the anonymous nature of it, what the ultimate people viewing it could interpret, whether there was a great likelihood of understanding that type of action as a message or some form of communication.
What about the note that was left? What did it say?
2 weeks later, there was a note left that had some obscenities towards golfers.
Didn't it say anything about the government?
Referred to some group as the anarchist platoon, but then the defendant, when interviewed, started laughing and said there's no such group.
But didn't the evidence show that the defendant was hostile to the government, as were his folks? Or am I misreading?
No, there was affidavit submitted after the fact where he expressed some anti-government feelings, but even beyond an expressed intent after the fact, the conduct has to be of a likelihood that the person viewing it would understand the communication and the message intended.
Now, suppose his message here was he doesn't like the golf club. As I read this now, I'll spare you the full reading of this language. But what he winds up saying, shove your club up your two-letter word, right? So he's expressing, maybe he's not hostile to the federal government or the state government, he's hostile to the club. Isn't that protective, expressive speech?
It doesn't really say what the message is. He's showing some dislike for rich people at a municipal golf course. So
it is expressive. And it's expressive against something, either the country, the flag, the rich folks of this country, or the golfers at the golf club. But it is expressive to one of those groups.
The note by itself expressed some disdain for rich golfers. That, I don't know, by itself necessarily warrants him to have First Amendment protection.
Mr. Biskupic, can we clarify when was the note left in relation to when there was defecation of the flag?
Approximately 2 to 3 weeks later, somewhere in that range.
All right, so this is after the fact as far as the charge that the defendant has faced.
The flag that was defecated on was cleaned up, put back, and then a few weeks later, it was stolen and the note was left.
Well, but he wasn't charged when this note was found, was he? That's, I think, the question. Had he been prosecuted yet?
Not at that point.
No, so he takes down two flags, or steals two flags, within the time period, shortly after he's stolen the flag or defecated on the flag, he leaves them a note, right? Golf course rich F's. You are dumb F's going to learn. When are you dumb F's going to learn? We stole your first flag and burnt it. Then we used your second flag for a shit rag and left it on. This is really very unpleasant, isn't it? I mean, this is not nice. And it's offensive. Aren't you offended?
It's offensive, it's horseplay, it's part of vandalism, it's part of the continuation of horseplay and theft.
I'm much more offended by this than I am at vandalism. Aren't you much more offended at this than vandalism? I certainly am. I'm very offended by this.
The anarchist platoon has invaded Appleton, and as long as you put flags up, we're going to burn them, you ducky F's. Shove your club up your... we know where. This is not a nice expression.
Aren't you more offended by this than somebody that paints, puts a couple of words on a sidewalk fence?
My reaction is, what is this person trying to convey? And it's idiotic. You don't know what he's trying to convey. Is he mad at the government? Is he mad at golfers? Is he mad at the prices at the municipal golf?
Does he have a First Amendment right, by the way, to express his anger at golfers?
I don't think to the same level as expression that we would historically have.
Is there a different level? Do we apply a different test if a person is going to express anger at government as opposed to anger at rich folks or at golfers or at country clubs? One is more susceptible of protection than the other?
Absolutely.
In terms of speech?
Absolutely. In United States v. O'Brien 30 years ago, the Justice Earl Warren said that not all conduct, even if there's an intent to express some idea, is worthy of this First Amendment protection.
So is your position then that if he had written all this about the government, it would be protected, but because it's written about golf clubs, I guess he's not protected? Is that your position?
My position is that not only would he have to be more clear in his writing, but the overall context of the situation needs to be created to create a likelihood that the people observing it understand it as a message of communication.
Is the charge related to the first incident? And in your complaint, you recite the date of the defecation on the flag?
Yes.
What date is used, if you remember?
I think it was June or July of 96.
Okay, and you're telling us 2 or 3 weeks later you have the note left?
Yes. See, my time's up.
Thank you, counsel. You have time for rebuttal. Mr. Bartman, you're a deputy first assistant state public defender representing Mr. Jansen.
Yes.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Gene Bartman. I represent defendant respondent Matthew Jansen. It's obvious from the questions so far in the presentation that this case raises some very important issues. The behavior, as just indicated in the question, that led to these charges has certainly offended and upset a lot of people. Very strong emotions have been aroused, but luckily we have a forum such as this where we can have a reasonable consideration of the principles. I think it's important to focus on what issues have already been decided before we arrive here today, as well as the issues that are left open to be decided in this case. This case is not about whether defecating on a flag is acceptable or unacceptable behavior. In arguing this case today, I certainly am not suggesting that I personally agree with that behavior or would expect anyone in this room to agree that that's a good thing or an appropriate thing to do. This case is rather about the power of the government in a free society and a democracy like ours to punish people who express disrespect, in this case, disrespect for the government's symbol, the flag. This case raises the issue of whether the principle that the flag stands for, in this case the First Amendment, is in fact...
He says it stands for the golf club. As I read that note, he's not angry at the American government. He's angry at the golf club. This happens to be golf club property. It could have been a golf flag. It could have been whatever else was at a golf club that he destroyed.
A tea flag.
A tea flag. That's a good one. Could have been a tea flag with this same kind of note. He doesn't seem to be out after the American flag. He's angry. You can interpret this. He's angry at rich people who go to golf clubs.
The mechanism by which he expressed his anger, not just on the day that he defecated on the flag, but as indicated in all the information in the record in this case over the period of several weeks or even months that summer, the mechanism by which he expressed his anger, the one where there was no question about what his message was the flag.
Well, would you protect him even if he's angry at the golf course?
Does he have
a First Amendment right?
Yes. I think he has a right to express his opinion.
It doesn't matter what he was angry at. He used the flag.
He used the flag, and by doing so made an expression about his contempt for the flag as the mechanism to express whatever other anger he had.
What if he had stolen the tee flag, went out to the first green and took the flag that's there, and did the exact same thing and left this message? Could he be prosecuted?
Well, he wouldn't be prosecuted under Wisconsin statute.
He could not be prosecuted for damage to property.
Absolutely.
And he was here, wasn't he? Didn't he get
he was prosecuted for theft.
Theft, okay.
For theft, Your Honor.
Theft of an American flag.
Yes.
So that's okay.
Counselor?
Well, could he have been prosecuted for damage to property of another? I noticed there's a statute in there that makes it illegal to damage property of another. Could he have been prosecuted under that?
Section 943.01 allows the district attorney to charge people who have damaged other people's property intentionally, yes.
So it's only because he was charged under this flag statute that we're here.
Absolutely. That's my point.
If he's under 943.01, damage to property of another, be a normal criminal case.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you'd have to establish that it was that this was property of another, not belonging to him, and he damaged it.
Yes.
It would be inconsequential whether it was an American flag or not. Could have been a flag on the first team.
And we're here to talk about the constitutionality of 946.05 sub 1, which makes it a felony to damage or defile, mutilate, cast contempt upon the flag. And that's the charge that the district attorney chose to issue against our client. And that's why we're here, because we believe that that statutory enactment is unconstitutionally overbroad, is vague, and is unconstitutional as applied to what our client did in this case.
What about the, then assuming that's true and that's your argument, the presumption of severability, the presumption for this court to look at legislation and then possibly sever language which would be offensive and would be unconstitutional?
I'd like to make three observations about that, because I believe that that is in fact the issue before this court. Whether or not the limiting construction, the severability issue, is something the court ought to adopt. And the points I'd like to make, first of all, is that if the court adopted the position of the district attorney, it won't solve the overbreath problem. Secondly, that this court can't solve, by severing sections, the overbreath problem with this statute because of its inherent purpose, and thirdly, that the court ought not follow the district attorney's recommendation and sever portions of the statute, because to do so is to rewrite the statute contrary to the legislative intent.
What legislative intent do we have here?
Not much. I'd like to differ from what's already been indicated to the court as to when the statute was created. I tracked the statute back to 1901. And about 18 years before it's been indicated here. And I didn't find any deliberate legislative history at that time. But later on, when the statute underwent a revision in 1955, I believe, when the criminal code was revamped, there's a note in the legislative history to suggest the type of behavior that this statute is designed to get at. And it makes it clear that it's designed to get at that behavior which is grossly contemptuous of the flag. So in terms of any written history, the only history I've been able to come up with is track the statute back to at least 1901. For all I know, it may be have its origins earlier than that. But we know that when the statute was revised, that it was, the note indicates it's to get a grossly contemptuous behavior towards the flag. So I think that suggests what type of behavior this, or what the purpose of the legislature was in passing this statute.
Is there anything in the legislative history, flimsy as it might be, that you were able to assign, which would indicate that the legislature would have been against enacting this statute if everything was gone from the statute except defile? In other words, if cast contempt was gone.
I think that the purpose of the statute is clear, to cast as broad a net as possible. All grossly contemptuous behavior. And I think by including all the terms, that's what they meant to do. And I think they saw that as the purpose of the statute. And to have the court go back and cut out sections, in other words, engage in severability of the statute, would be to take away grossly contemptuous behavior that the legislature meant to include.
Well, wouldn't defile be grossly contemptuous behavior?
Yes. That's
then
a
then
part of it.
How would we be running contrary to the legislative intent?
Because this body would be taking away portions of the types of grossly contemptuous behavior that the legislature meant to include. I see it as a whole, that they meant to include all of that type of behavior.
Counsel, you don't really mind if we take away the contemptuous, the caste contempt, or even the mutilate. The defendant was charged with defiling, and as I understand your position, even as severed, it is overbroad.
That was the first point, that adopting the narrowing construction won't solve the overbreath problem, because the statute will still read and punish intentional and public defiling. In other words, those words as well indicate an intent on the part of the statute to get at expressive conduct. The defiling of the flag, intentional and public defiling of the flag, will still cover a substantial amount of constitutionally protected expression. As some of the questions already indicated, it would still cover that. Defiling the flag would cover any defiling during a political demonstration, artistic exhibition, or any other type of protected conduct. As long as it was intentional and public defiling, anything that made the flag unclean, that the law enforcement officer or the prosecutor felt, in their opinion, was not clearly enough expressed as a political message, for instance, would then find itself prosecuted.
And your position is it doesn't matter whether he intended to cast contempt on the American government, that he has standing to raise overbreath.
Yes.
So it's irrelevant what his intent was.
The action itself, by choosing the flag, the intent that he had was to choose the flag as the mechanism.
That puts him under the statute, regardless of his intent.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And that's his expressive act. And that's what he's allowed under the Constitution to do, is to make an expression.
Let me ask you, do you agree with the petitioner's position that in examining an overbreath issue, that the court must look at the statute and say, can we, if we narrow it, and then we look at the overbreath objection, can we handle it on a case-by-case basis, or, in the alternative, is there a real and substantial overbreath problem we have to throw the whole thing out? Is that the analysis?
Yeah, I believe that the court ought to look at the fact that we're dealing with expressive conduct inherently whenever we deal with a flag protection statute.
I'm just asking about the level of analysis. Those are the two. That you can do it on a case-by-case basis if there aren't a lot of those kinds of cases out there. But if it's a real and substantial overbreath problem, the court must find it, even just the defiling part, unconstitutional. Is that your position?
I'm asking that the court find that a statute that punishes defiling the flag is inherently overbroad.
And your argument is that there's real and substantial overbreath here.
Yes, because of the purpose. It's not so much...
How do you know that? That's what I think...
I was trying to get to the level, and then how do you know that this... What is your position as to why, if we delete everything else from the statute and just use the intentional and public defiling, why is there a real and substantial overbreath problem here?
That has to do with the fact that any use of the flag, because the flag is a symbol, and it's not being protected as a piece of property, but it's used as a symbol, that any disrespectful act involving it, any defiling, is inherently disrespectful, shows contempt, and as a result is expressive. And so there cannot be intentional and public non-expressive conduct towards that involves defiling.
Counsel, suppose I have a flag and it's in bad condition. There's been a bad storm. I've flown it in a bad storm. It is now ripped to shreds, and I want to get rid of it, and I am at a loss to figure out how I can do that. And so I decide that while I legally burn leaves, I'm going to burn the flag. It's going to be intentional mutilation of this flag, public, right where everybody can see me. Now, I have no intent to make an expressive statement other than to say I have to get rid of something that's in bad shape. So, and with all due deference to the government, I burn the flag. In fact, out of deference to the government, I burn the flag.
In fact, I think that's the correct way to get rid of the flag, isn't it?
Right. It is. And so, you would be expressing a very positive message and an act of respect towards the flag.
Well,
and you'd be making an expression through your mutilation of the flag.
All I'm trying to do is get rid of it. I'm really not trying to say anything. I don't want to keep it. I got too much clutter in the house. I just want to get rid of it. I'm not making any statement other than the fact It's in bad shape. I gotta get rid of it. I'm not expressing anything.
I would just indicate that by choosing that method, the ceremonious and proper method of disposing of the flag as a way of showing proper respect, you are making an expression. Even if that wasn't your intent, you by going that way, you are making sending a message. And you're sending a message that it's more important to you to do it that way than it is to toss it.
All I'm trying to do is there must be some example we can give you that does not express a viewpoint.
Yeah, what if I, in the dark of night, I need something to carry my cat outside with or something, and I grab the nearest piece of cloth that will act as sort of a baggage carrier. I have no idea that it's a flag. And I go outside with it. And it's instantly recognized under the streetlight to be a flag that I'm carrying garbage in.
My point is that we have to go very far afield to try to find an example of how we could defile the flag without making a point.
But that isn't that,
and that helps.
Isn't that exactly your opponent's point? That there are instances in which this kind of statute would pass muster.
And my response is no, because the instance that you've now described, after we've tried to find an example, and it's very difficult to do, and I think that helps show the real and substantial overbreadth issue raised by a statute that prohibits defiling the flag. The one that you came up with doesn't involve intentional and public defilement of the flag, because any activity that's going to fit this statute is going to be expressive. That's why a limiting construction to a statute that only punishes the intentional and public defiling of the flag can't pass constitutional muster.
Is that because of the overbreadth example? He didn't pay any attention that it was a flag, so it wasn't an intent to defile? Is that why? I'm just trying to understand your argument.
What I'm understanding in that example is that it was an accidental defiling of the flag. Accidental defilement of the flag wouldn't be covered by the statute we're talking about. Any public and intentional defiling of the flag, which is the construction being recommended to this court, is going to be expressive. That's why severing out two of the three terms, doing a line item veto on the statute, will not save its constitutionality.
Well, let me give you one more example, because I'm still not convinced that there aren't examples. An example is that it's garbage day, everybody's in the street taking their garbage on, I rip the flag off, I want to get rid of it, I'm going to defile it because I'm going to throw it in the garbage with all my other garbage. There's no communication, I'm just getting rid of it, as Justice Abrahamson was. Can that be prosecuted? I intentionally threw the flag, I knew it was the flag, I threw it in the garbage. It was in the public, there were people around.
I don't believe that could be constitutionally punished, because it's just like the example in footnote 3 in the Johnson case. Under Wisconsin's law, which as recommended would prohibit and punish and criminalize intentional and public defiling of the flag, even the behavior that you've described indicates that you meant disrespect for the flag, that it wasn't worth it.
Let's assume for a moment that it could be prosecuted. Does that defeat your argument on overbreath? If that is an example of something that could be prosecuted.
No, because my argument on overbreath is that we have to show that the statute would, in a real and substantial way, cover a lot, mostly cover constitutionally protected. I don't believe it has to be all, but my argument is that any flag protection statute inherently covers symbolic behavior, because the item that you've chosen to react towards is a symbol. And the only time people would get upset and want to prosecute behavior towards a symbol is if you send the wrong message toward that symbol. In other words, you act contemptuously towards it. You decide it's not worth disposing of in the right way. It's not worth picking up out of the mud. And that type of behavior could be prosecuted, because the statute, as it's being proposed to you, intentionally and publicly defiling the flag, suffers not only from overbreadth, in that it will cover substantial amount of constitutionally protected activity. Nearly every activity, if not all activity, would be constitutional.
The problem I have with your argument is it seems to me what you're arguing is that if others find it contemptuous, it doesn't matter what the intent of the person is that is performing the act. I mean, if my intent or the Chief Justice's intent was to get rid of this flag and was not meant to show contempt on the flag, but others, because it is a symbol, felt that it was contemptuous, that's enough to protect speech. And it seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong on this, that you have to look at the person as to whether or not they intended it to be an expression protected.
I think the issue that question raises goes to the second problem that I have with the proposal being made. Not only is there this problem that severing the statute sections, the words, won't cure its overbreath problem, and it can't because inherently flag protection statutes have as their main purpose, it doesn't matter the words, but the purpose or intent is to protect the flag as a symbol. But it also gets to the issue of vagueness. And it's not so much vagueness as the Court of Appeals looked at vagueness, which was that the word carries with it a meaning that the public may generally not understand. It doesn't put you on notice. That's a problem, as we've already seen in the argument today, which definition you pick. So obviously there's a number of ways you can define the word defile, which is going to create a vagueness issue and is going to open the door to other litigation about whether certain conduct was really defiling. But more important than that gets to your question, which deals with the issue of who's going to interpret when it becomes a constitutionally protected defiling, or whether it's this accidental or unintentional one that may not be constitutionally protected. And this statute, without guidelines, is the type of statute struck down in Kohlender versus Lawson in 1983 by the United States Supreme Court as vague, not because the words weren't understood, but because it didn't set standards for law enforcement. And so we're left with a situation where this very broad statute that carries with it the very real danger of causing confusion on the part of people as to when their behavior is going to be constitutionally protected and when it's not, is left in the hands of law enforcement to interpret.
Well, didn't the Court of Appeals take the approach that there was no vagueness here because of the fact that no one could fail to have notice that defecating on the flag would be a defilement? Now, how do you get around the discussion by the Court of Appeals?
First of all, the Court of Appeals didn't address the second prong of vagueness, which is the one I want to emphasize and did emphasize in the brief to the Court of Appeals, and that is the standardless law enforcement, the fact that you could have arbitrary law enforcement because there are no standards in the statute. In this area, and I think more directly to your question, the principles of vagueness, when you're challenging a First Amendment implicating statute, the principle of vagueness and the principle of overbreath are extremely related.
I agree.
In State versus Steele, there's reference made to the article by Richard Fallon in the Yale Law Journal on overbreath. And he specifically, in that article, says the two principles have a common rationale. But a stronger claim is warranted in First Amendment vagueness doctrine, as distinct from ordinary or non-First Amendment vagueness doctrine, is best conceptualized as a subpart of First Amendment overbreath. And in Kohlender versus Lawson, the dissent wanted to make the point that there was a different standing issue as it related to bringing up a vagueness issue, just as you've identified that the Court of Appeals mentioned. And that is, clearly defecating on the flag fits a definition of defiling. The problem is that the confusion over whether it fits within the statute or could fit within the statute comes in whether or not the act of defiling was constitutionally protected or it wasn't constitutionally protected. In other words, that's the issue in the case. If this act falls outside of the statute because it was constitutionally protected expressive conduct, then it's not defiling as the statute could properly punish. And therefore, it's not obvious that it falls within the language of the statute and you couldn't raise a First Amendment vagueness challenge. Because then our client would have every right to raise the issue of whether or not this statute was vague as it referred to him. Because the two concepts are so interrelated, if this were a non-First Amendment case, then the two concepts don't have the same purpose, may not have the same purpose. I can't speak for all cases, but they may not have as clearly the same purpose that they do here. The purpose behind these challenges is to try to strike down the right of the government to chill, to have a statute that could be used to chill freedom of expression.
In other words, you're really saying that the Court of Appeals was wrong in separating vagueness and overbreath the way they did in their opinion.
Yes, that's my position. My position is that the two, in this type of case, and there may be other cases where it's appropriate to make the separation, but in First Amendment cases like this one, the two are so closely related, the policies are identical, and therefore there shouldn't be any difference in standing between the two.
Do you think this case is on all fours with Eichmann?
If we look at the Flag Protection Act of 1989, passed in response to the Johnson decision, you'll find that nearly identical language to the language of the Wisconsin statute. In other words, mutilates will be in there, and defile will be in there. So that part of the statute that the state is proposing that this court keep finds its way into or would be part of the Wisconsin statute, and is the same language we find in the Flag Protection Act. The difference between the two cases, and the reason I can't say it's on, honestly can't say it's on all fours, is because of the decision in this case that the conduct by our client was not expressive conduct protected by the First Amendment. And so the Supreme Court in Eichmann didn't strike the statute as being facially invalid because it didn't have to. I believe that this court doesn't have to do that either because our conduct in this case, we're asking the court to review the trial court's decision that this was not expressive conduct. And if the court does that and finds that our client's conduct in this case was expressive conduct under the First Amendment, then it is proper to find the prosecution unconstitutional because the law would be unconstitutional as applied. But if the court affirms, this court affirms the trial court's determination that the conduct is not First Amendment protected conduct, then we get to the bigger issue, and that is whether or not Wisconsin's statute on its face is unconstitutional. And we believe both are true.
Counsel, I ask your opponent here if this was expressive conduct towards rich folks or towards country clubs, whether or not that would deserve the same measure of protection under the First Amendment as expressive conduct towards the government. I believe he said no. Is that your answer?
No, I don't have the authority to cite to the court, but I think expressive conduct can be
regardless
towards
of who it is directed to.
Yes.
Has got First Amendment protection.
It could be any kind of policy, an opinion about anything, any issue that someone had. I don't agree that in this case that message indicates that disapproval was just towards the golf course. You have to look at the context of what occurred in this case, and that was to use the American flag. The thing that the object of the attention of the writer of that message was the flag. And the fact that the writer of that message has indicated in affidavits that he identified the flag at that location, a municipal golf course, as a government facility. Now, I don't think it's proper to let it up to the government, this goes with the vagueness claim, to make a determination that a particular letter or note or expression is articulated clear enough that if it were more artfully done, more intelligently done, and we could understand it better in terms of the particular object of wrath, that therefore that becomes more expressive and unpunishable than if somebody who's not particularly articulate leaves a message, and then it's left up to law enforcement to say, well, we're not quite clear on what the message is, therefore we can go after this because it's not sufficiently communicative. And that's one of the issues that this statute, especially the vagueness, part of it, the vagueness challenge raises. In this particular case, we're asking that the court not only consider the fact that it can't cure the overbreath problem, won't cure the overbreath problem by limiting the construction of the statute, that it shouldn't limit the overbreath by limiting, or I'm sorry, it shouldn't rewrite the statute. Recent cases in Hall and in Roten, this court has said that there are limits to how far the court ought to go in rewriting a statute to try to save its constitutionality. In this case, the purpose to punish grossly contemptuous behavior is clear. And this court would have to eliminate intentional, would have to eliminate public, would have to eliminate casting contempt and mutilation, and I would argue the filing is still overbroad. And I don't know how the court could construe the statute in such a way consistent with the intent to punish grossly contemptuous behavior, how it could write that in a way that wouldn't subvert the purpose of the statute.
Mr. Barvin, do you see a difference between severability, or striking words from a statute, and adding words, writing in words to a statute as far as the court legislating?
Well, there's a difference in terms of just mechanically doing that, obviously. I don't think that there's a legal distinction. In a case like this where you're taking out, for instance, if you had to take out intentionally or publicly along with casting contempt, it'd be so massive a rewriting of the statute that it would be just like you wrote in additional terms saying we're going to eliminate other types of behavior.
Well, wouldn't it be true that the presumption of severability would apply to one and not to the other?
I not that I'm aware of.
Now, when was the statute on the presumption of severability passed? Do you know?
No, I don't.
Thank you, counsel.